paste the book of Habakkuk. And I mentioned that I never saw anybody in high school named Habakkuk, and there's nobody else in the Bible named Habakkuk. It's certainly an unusual name, and we discussed that last time in our introduction and also as we went into the story. I am finding, you might find it interesting, I'm finding this labor-intensive, this book of Habakkuk. It's really something. There's a lot more to it, and I am sure that there's a lot more in the book than I know, because various commentators will make certain references to things. There are parallelisms, and there are many things that are there, and there are even things in the Hebrew where Hebrew words rhyme, and to be able to have all that in place will take some time. So obviously, I'm just beginning to understand it. Although, on the other hand, the message itself is very plain, and it's quite straightforward in a certain way. It's just there's more to it, and with God, you know, the truth is plain, and yet there's always more to understand. There's a greater depth that comes with time. And you remember that Habakkuk was concerned that things weren't going right. The burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw, "Oh Lord, how long shall I cry and you will not hear, and even cry out to you violence and you will not save? Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me, and there's strife and contention arises. Therefore the law is powerless, for justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, perverse judgment proceeds." Things aren't right, and the righteous can't get things going in the right direction. And he's very concerned about it. As we mentioned last time, there were certain indications that he was a priest. Certain indications in the book, which I covered last time. And God answers him in a way that he wasn't expecting. He says, "Look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe though it were told you," God responds to him. "For indeed I'm raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation, which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful, their judgments and their dignity precede themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards and more fierce than evening wolves. Their chargers charge ahead, and their cavalry from afar. They fly as an eagle that hastens to eat. They all come for violence. Their faces are set like the east wind. They gather captives like sand. They scoff at kings, and princes are scorned by them. They deride every stronghold, for they heap up earth and mounds and seize it. Then his mind changes, and he transgresses. He commits offense, ascribing this power to his God. He claims it's his God that's going to deliver him." And this was something that Habakkuk, you know, he asked this, and one commentator says that he asked this question, and when the answer comes, it says it drives Habakkuk to his knees, because he wasn't expecting that answer. And we got to that. We covered all that last time. I want to pick it up again in verse 12. Because I have learned some things since we were last in here that I think you'll find interesting. So Habakkuk, now he's got his answer, but he goes back to God because he's got another question, to say the least. And Habakkuk 1, verse 12. "Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have appointed them for judgment, O Rock. You have marked them for correction," or for punishment. I'll read that again from the, I won't read it again. I'll just go from there. But I'm going to use the NIV. You have the NIV in my notes, and I have the King James here. So combine the two. So he goes back to him and says, "O Lord," verse 12, "are you not from everlasting, my God, my Holy One? We will not die." Now, what I've learned from last time, I mentioned last time that when he says, "O Lord," he refers to the covenant name, and we went back to Exodus to see that. YHVH is God calls the Lord, is translated, and that's his name for the covenant, which he said. Then he said, "My God, my Holy One, we will not die." This carries the same worshipful respect and also personalizes Habakkuk's heartfelt request. He calls on the God, the Holy One of Israel, and he is the Holy One of Israel. He's the one who is going to make Israel, all overcomers, holy, and he's the one that's going to do it. The Sansino commentary, which is a Jewish commentary, says Habakkuk's distress of mind is not stilled by God's answer, and he asks, surely God cannot intend the total destruction of his people, but only their correction. Now, I mentioned that last time, and that view suggests that Habakkuk knew or understood the many prophecies that indicate God would chastise Israel, but he would never let them perish as a people. Well, maybe he did, but there's something else I've learned from the Companion Bible that I didn't know last time. He said, we shall not die, the Companion Bible. This is one of the 18 emendations of the Sopharim, the scribes. Now, an emendation means they changed it. See Appendix 33. Those of you who have a Companion Bible or have access to one, they're all 18 are laid out, which say they made because it was considered offensive to say this to Jehovah. Hence, the one word in the primitive text, who dieth not, was changed to who die not. That, in English grammar, means you're changing it from the second person to the first. This is the only one of those 18 emendations which the Revised Version and the American Revised Version notice and speak of it in the margin as ancient Jewish tradition. My New King James does not have it in it, and the New International does not note it in it. Whereas a list of such emendations is given in the Masoreth. That's the marginal notes. When they write it out in Hebrew, they have marginal notes. And it's kept faithfully in the marginal notes in Hebrew that this was amended. This was changed. The change from the second person, you, to the first person, we, did more than avoid the supposed irreverent expression. It transferred to mortal men the truth which apart from the resurrection pertains to God only. And then he quotes 1 Timothy 6:16, who only has immortality. So we shall not die. And John Bullinger in his Companion Bible says, well, that means we shall not die, that we're immortal. The Sansino, the Jewish commentary, acknowledges the change made by the Sopharim. They claim the reason was the change was that they found, quote, the mere suggestion of mortality in connection with God repugnant. Now, from my perspective, Habakkuk doesn't say God's mortal. It doesn't even imply it. He says, you shall not die. His statement plainly states that. With that change, it becomes, in verse 12a, becomes, O Lord, are you not from everlasting, my God, my Holy One? You will not die. And that's what the Jews found offensive. So much so, they decided to change it. Is Habakkuk saying, you won't die, but when you send those brutal Chaldeans, we will? Is that the implication? Perhaps that's the real reason the Sopharim felt the need to amend the text. They thought, well, that's all. You can't say that to God, so they felt that they should change it. It's an amazing thing. The other 18 are only minor, very minor. This is the most major one, according to Mr. Bullinger. And he continues the rest in the second half of verse 12. O Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment. He's acknowledging that that's what God said. O rock, you have ordained them to punish. And that's the sense of it. He's not arguing with it. Habakkuk acknowledges what God has said he was about to do. But he's also lamenting the decision and asks God for a clarification. And later, God will clarify. But now, Habakkuk continues. Verse 13, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? Israel has these problems, as if he's saying, but the Chaldeans are worse. They are treacherous, Habakkuk says. They are wicked. How can God simply look on while such evil and wrong are happening? Verse 5, he said, look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed, for I'm going to do something in your days that you will not believe even if you were told. Habakkuk is truly, utterly amazed at what God said. Now notice verse 14 and 15. This is the NIV. You have made men like fish in the sea, like sea creatures that have no ruler. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net, and he gathers them up in his dragnet, and so rejoices and is glad. Now he says he pulled them up like sea creatures that have no rulers. And he likens people, he's just hauling in, the Chaldean is hauling in these people all over the earth. From Habakkuk's point of view, they were having great success. And and they have no ruler. They have no way to organize to be able to fight back or to protect themselves. In that sense, the Chaldeans are scoring victory after victory. Sansino says, some understand this verse as a reproach to God. Why do you treat the righteous as the fishes of the sea to be caught in the net of the wicked, leaving them to their fate? Habakkuk's really letting God know what his opinion is and his concern. He's respectful, but he presents his questions. And I said, like sea creatures that have no ruler. Sea creatures can't organize, I've already mentioned that. And in that sense, they're completely helpless and vulnerable. They're just waiting to get caught. Verse 16, he said, therefore they sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their dragnet, because by them their share is sumptuous and their food plenty. NIV says, therefore he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet, for by his net he lives in luxury and enjoys the choicest food. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? This didn't seem right to Habakkuk. How can this be happening? The Chaldeans were going around capturing and winning, and they put out their net, they empty it, they put it out again, empty it, put it out again, just taking nation after nation after nation. And they empty it so quickly so they can fill it again. And how long, he asked God, will they keep destroying nations in their unmerciful way? Because this seems very strange to God's servant Habakkuk. How could this be? Now we'll jump into chapter 2. After saying that, he said, I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. He said, I'm going to stand there. Now, he was a prophet, and God worked with him in a certain way, and maybe they had some way of communicating, and he knew he'd go over here and stand there and go, answer your question. But he had spoken his mind from the heart. And now he awaits God's reply. I hope all of us have sometime or another spoken our mind to God respectfully and talked to him. And like Habakkuk feels free to do, to just say, why is this the way it is? How can this be? And yet in confidence, in trusting God, but, you know, sincerely saying, I don't understand, or help me understand this, or help me get this clear. It's a very important principle for us all. So he's going to push himself. He's going to put himself where he should, and on the ramparts, which implies the walls of the city. I will look to see what he will say to me. Habakkuk is eager to hear what God would say in response. God has spoken to him in the past, and he's confident he'll receive a reply. He's just waiting for the reply. But other translations suggest he is also anticipates being corrected for questioning God's justice. The New King James says, and what I will answer when I am corrected. The Jewish Publication Society says, and what I shall answer when I am reproved. So in a way, he's kind of expecting to be criticized or reproved for his boldness or whatever it might be, or for his view, because he's implying God's not just in a sense, but he doesn't understand it. So he's asking, and what I will answer, what answer I am to give to this complaint. Now, Habakkuk is a wise man. He wants to hear what God has to say and then formulate a reply. So he's saying, I want to hear what he has to say and then what answer I will give afterwards. He doesn't say, I'm right and I know I'm right. He said, this is my view. This is my perception, and I'm sharing it with you. Please help me to see. Help me to understand. That's quite a thing. So after stating his questions, he now awaits God's reply before saying anything else. And God does reply. Verses 2 and 3 of chapter 2. Then the Lord replied, write down the revelation and make it plain on tablets, so that a herald may run with it. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end and will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. Now, God tells them, now pay special attention to what I'm about to tell you. And I want you to write it down. Write down the revelation and make it plain on tablets. Habakkuk is to write God's reply, we understand, to be baked clay tablets. There may be some other thing there, but he's to write it down. And many such tablets have been found in archaeological digs. They find them in various times. I want you to get this so that it's there. Make it. So a herald may run with it. And make it easy to read so a herald can get the word out quickly. That's that's one way to say it. The English, the King James translation of that has come into the language as an expression, that he may run that reads it, which implies he'll be equipped to know what to do. The JPS says that a man may read it swiftly. They talk about how he reads it, make it very plain so it's easy, and they want to read it quickly and be able to do it. It could be also that a man can read what God's going to do and prepare himself and get out of trouble. But he can run that reads it, that he can see what's going to happen and hide himself. Or it could be, as implied by the NIV, that there was a herald. A herald is an official representative that God raises up to announce something. Now, apparently, Habakkuk was the writer. And God would, at another time, raise up a herald to get it out, or the individual. It depends how that's to be understood. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end and will not prove false. So God's telling Habakkuk and all of us that it's going to wait for an appointed time. So it's not the immediate future. It's a little further down than that. but an appointed time. And the end is usually thought to mean the retribution upon the Chaldeans. I'm going to say what's going to happen. It's going to come back on the Chaldeans, but it's going to be a time. But of course, God was surely had as well, and it did take, the Chaldeans were destroyed, their empire was gone, of course, but he's probably also looking ahead to the end of the age that we're in too, because the thing's going to repeat all over again, amazingly. That it goes again. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. The time is appointed. It speaks of the end. As I said, it's thought to mean the retribution upon the Chaldeans, and will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. The appointed time is in the future, but it will happen exactly as God says. The revelation will not delay, that is, it will not be later than the intended time. There's an intended time there, and it's going to happen when it's supposed to happen. It'll be right on schedule, right when it's supposed to be. Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4. God continues, "See, he is puffed up. His desires are not upright, but the righteous will live by his faith. Indeed, wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest, because he is as greedy as the grave, and like death, is never satisfied. So he gathers to himself all the nations and takes captive of all the peoples." See, he is puffed up, and his desires are not upright. In a way, that's saying, you got it right, Habakkuk. He's not a nice person. That Habakkuk was seeing it clearly. He'd say, look what he's doing. Look how he does. Look how he is. And God's saying, yes, that's exactly right. The Chaldeans have serious problems. And when it says he, you know, in the Bible, usually a king is synonymous with a kingdom. Remember, he's going to raise up 10 kings? Well, of course, that's 10 nations. And that's in Bible prophecy, the way it works, that the leader represents the whole group, because he usually epitomizes the whole group. So it's likened in that way. Now, this famous phrase, tucked in here, but the righteous will live by his faith. And that phrase is one of the most famous in the Bible. The righteous will live by his faith. The Sonsino, the Jewish commentary, says, the Hebrew word emunah, E-M-U-N-A-H, does not signify faith in the Bible, but steadfastness, faithfulness. It is used of Moses' uplifted hands, which were steady. Remember, they held his arms up and they were steady. It's the same word. And that's Exodus, if I type this right, 17:12. And of men in charge of money who dealt faithfully. It's translated, dealt faithfully. That's in 2 Kings 12:16. What is here intended is the righteous Israelite who remains unswervingly loyal to moral precepts will endure, although he has to suffer for his principles. Whereas the wicked who enjoy a temporary ascendancy through their violation of right are in the end overthrown and humbled. The righteous will live by his faith or by his steadfastness. Now that's a great promise for Habakkuk, that if somebody is following God, they'll be okay. Expositor's Bible Dictionary, this brief clause of three Hebrew words epitomizes the response of the steadfast commitment demanded in verses 2-3 of chapter 1. And it thereby answers Habakkuk's concern for the righteous in Judah, imperiled by the judgment intended for the wicked. Compare 1:13. In 1:13, it says, You are purer than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously? And that's the same, that's a word for that's used there. Contrary to appearances, the judgment of God is selective and awe-inspiring in its precision. In the midst of disaster, his grace overshadows the righteous and causes them to live. And then he puts in Psalm 91. Famous song, psalm about living. Both Paul and a later rabbinic tradition found in this pregnant statement a summary of the Old Testament way of salvation. They diverge radically, however, in their beliefs concerning the attainment of such saving righteousness. Paul had one idea, the rabbinic had another. And we know that Paul uses that. We covered some of those last time, the verses where he says the just shall live by faith. Let me just show you one in Hebrews, in the book of Hebrews chapter 10. And remember that word steadfastness that's used there. And that's used in the New Testament. And we've gone over that word in past years many, many times in our congregation. It's the word I don't pronounce it properly. I call it hupomone. It's the word for steadfastness. Remember Jesus said that he that endures to the end will be saved. That word is the word that's translated steadfastness. He that endures to the end. Now, here in Hebrews chapter 10, in verse 32, writing there, and it's thought this is the Apostle Paul, it's my understanding of it, but he's reminding the Hebrews Christians, but remember the former days in which after you were illuminated, after the light went on, you endured, that's that a form of that word, you endured a great struggle with sufferings. To become a Christian in Acts 2, in the first chapters of Acts, was to put yourself in a position of persecution because they had just crucified Christ and they were against the Christian, but people stood up anyway. He said, after you endured a great struggle with suffering, partly while you were made a spectacle both by reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated, other Christians. For you had compassion on me in my chains, the Apostle Paul was in chains in Jerusalem. And he said, you had compassion on me in my chains and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods. People would take things from them, knowing that you have a better and enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward, your confidence in God and his promises, for you have need of endurance. And that's that form of that word, hupomone. So that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. For yet a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith. But if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. They'll live by faith. But if they draw back to the old ways, back of walking our own ways, he says, my soul has no pleasure in him. Then he says in verse 39, but we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. It's either back or forward. And we have to go forward to the saving of the soul. Let me show you one more in the New Testament, Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3. My Bible has a heading between 6 and 7 of Revelation 3, the faithful church. And to the angel of the church of Philadelphia write, these things says he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, and who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it, for you have a little strength, and have kept my word, and have not denied my name. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet and know that I have loved you. Because you have kept my command to persevere. And that's the form of that word, hupomone. You've kept my command, which he gave in Habakkuk. And he gave in Matthew 24, verse 13, he who endures to the end. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no man take your crown. We know those verses. That's there. So this thing, but the righteous will live by his faith. He will live by, and as both they say, it's the steadfastness rather than the word we think of faith. But they're, you know, obviously closely related. Faith and steadfastness are very similar. Only the one emphasizes the believing, and the other emphasizes continual, unstopping believing, trusting God, that doesn't end. So both are in there. Okay, let's go back to Habakkuk, where he says, "See, he is puffed up. His desires are not upright, but the righteous will live by his faith." That's a promise that's answering the question that he had. How can this be? Will you let the wicked devour somebody more righteous than themselves? The righteous will live by his faith. Indeed, going back to the Chaldeans, wine betrays him. Wine betrays him. The Expositor's Bible commentary says, betrays translates the same verb as treacherous in chapter 1, verse 13. Wine, like the Babylonians, is deceptive and unreliable. Although drunk to enhance one's life, wine impoverishes, confuses, and destroys. And then they have a whole line of scriptures from the Proverbs about and Isaiah about wine and not taking too much wine, which is definitely a problem. Sonsino adds this: they are addicted to drunkenness. The vice is treacherous. We're going back to that other translation of the word. Inasmuch as wine befogs the mind. Roman writers have mentioned the inordinate partiality of the Babylonians for strong drink. And the Jewish exegetes, people who explain the Bible, quote in connection with this verse, the incident in Daniel 5. You want to look at Daniel 5? Daniel chapter 5. How did the Babylonians get into trouble? Daniel chapter 5. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of 1,000. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple and which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, his concubines might drink from them. They were going to go drinking from the temple vessels. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, his concubines drank from them. They drank wine, and they praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron and wood and stone. That's the ones that made up the image, you may remember. Gold, silver, bronze, iron, and then wood and stone. In the same hour, while they're drinking out of the holy garment from the temple, in the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand and on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw part of the hand that wrote, just a piece of a hand sticking up there writing on the wall. That would be quite a thing to see. I mean, that'd get your attention, wouldn't it? Then the king's countenance changed. Before he was happy, now he's not happy. And his thoughts troubled him so that the joints of his hips were loosed and his knees knocked against each other. The king cried aloud to bring out the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me the interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be third ruler in the kingdom." Now all the king's wise men came, and they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. Now, none of his guys could tell him what it meant. And his countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. They were astonished at how this upset him. He became sort of unhinged. Well, then the queen comes and reminds him about Daniel, who had worked with his father and grandfather. And he says in verse 11, there is a man in your kingdom in whom the Spirit of the Holy God, and whom is the Spirit of the Holy God, and in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. So they get Daniel, and he explains it. Now, I'll just sum it up here. Where am I going to go? Verse 22. But you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. He knew what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drank wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron and wood and stone, which do not hear, which do not see or hear or know, and the God who holds your breath in his hand. You ever think about somebody holding your breath? In his hand, and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and his writing was written. And this is the inscription that was written: many, many, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word. Many, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Then Belshazzar, can you imagine, they're all hearing Daniel say this, this big party that everybody's all of a sudden quiet at. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold on his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. And Darius the Mede received his kingdom, being about 62 years old. So that was short-lived. It was the wine. He says, "Wayne," God said, the wine would do him in. Wine would finish him up. He said, indeed, wine betrays him. And so it did. Then God continues in Habakkuk. He is arrogant and never at rest. Inflamed by wine, the Chaldeans lost all sense of caution. And they were restless and they were ruthless. But because he is as greedy as the grave, and like death is never satisfied. He gathers to himself all the nations and take captives of all the peoples. As greedy as the grave. You know, the grave is never full. If you go to Isaiah chapter 5, God makes a similar statement to the children of Israel. It's not identical, but it's surprisingly close. Isaiah chapter 5, Isaiah chapter 5, verse 11. Woe to those who rise early in the morning, that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue until night, till wine inflames them. The harp and the strings and the tambourine and the flute and the wine are in their feasts, but they do not regard the work of the Lord, nor consider the operation of his hands. Isn't that the way our society is today? Is partying all the time and music and things like this and all this entertainment. But people are not aware of what's happening in the nation. Their minds are elsewhere. It's kind of frightening to see so much happening and so many people not even staying on top of it, at least being aware of it or thinking about it or seeing the sober times in which we live. It says, the harp and the strings, the tambourine, the flute, and the wine at their feasts, but they do not regard the work of the Lord, nor consider the operation of his hands. Therefore, my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. Their honorable men are famished, and their multitude dried up with thirst. Therefore, Sheol has enlarged itself and opened its mouth beyond measure with the wine and then the grave. Their glory and their multitude and their pomp and he who is jubilant shall descend into it. People shall be brought down, each man shall be humbled, and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. But the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God who is holy shall be hallowed in the righteous. He goes on talking about that a little further down. So he said, but he is greedy as the grave, and like death is never satisfied. This Chaldean, he just can't get enough. He wants more kingdoms, and that's the way we humans are. We start getting on a roll, and we don't stop. He gathers to himself all the nations and take captives of all the people. He wanted to dominate the whole world. And that's what these world leaders, when they get a chance to do, they want to do. They want to control everything. They want the whole thing. You know, he gathers to himself all the nations and take captives of all the people. Habakkuk could ask, won't he just keep on destroying? Won't he just keep on taking nations captive? And God replies, yes, he will. But I'm going to stop him, and I'm going to humble him. And then he goes down in verse 2. And these verses are almost self-explanatory. Chapter 2, verse 6. Will not all of them taunt him with ridicule and scorn, saying, woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion. How long must this go on? Will not your debtors suddenly arise? Will they not wake up and make you tremble? Then you will become their victim, because you have plundered many nations. The peoples who are left will plunder you, for you have shed man's blood, and you have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. And God was witness to it all, and he's aware, and he was watching. And God continues, woe to him who builds up his realm by unjust gain to set his nest on high, to escape the clutches of ruin. Even today, our political leaders are trying to get on top and to get themselves ahead. Things don't change, just the scale of it changes. Woe to him who builds his realm by unjust gain to set his nest on high, to escape the clutches of ruin. You have plotted the ruin of many peoples, shaming your own house and forfeiting your life. The stones of the wall will cry out, and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. They're all witness. It's all there to see. Verse 12. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes a town by crime. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire, that the nations exhaust themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Here's that prophecy similar to the one in Isaiah. He's having this time of prosperity. He's up there now. But woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes a town by crime. And the people's labor is only fuel for the fire. It's just going to all be destroyed. That the nations exhaust themselves for nothing. They're not going to have their way. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. This is God's plan, that everybody gets to know the truth. But right now, it's not out there. Right now, it's not the time. The time is when Christ returns, that the whole world gets it. Right now, he's just calling out a few. He's calling out the church to learn his ways. But eventually, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Verse 15. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pouring it from the wineskin till they're drunk, so he can gaze on their naked bodies. Is that what Belteshazzar was doing, trying to get everybody really juiced up? And then they go into all kinds of things. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbors, pouring it from the wineskin till they are drunk, so he can gaze on their naked bodies. You will be filled with shame instead of glory. Now it is your turn. Drink and be exposed. Excuse me. The cup from the Lord's right hand is coming around to you, and disgrace will cover your glory. The violence you have done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and your destruction of the animals will terrify you. For you have shed man's blood, you have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. Verse 18. Of what value is an idol, since a man has carved it? Or what image that teaches lies? For he who makes it trusts in his own creation. He makes idols that cannot speak. Woe to him who says to wood, remember they would worship the work of their hands, their net, their things, their tools of war. Woe to him who says to wood, come to life, or to lifeless stone, wake up. Can it give guidance? It is covered with gold and silver. There is no breath in it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. Now that's God's response to the tough questions that his servant Habakkuk asked. And God answers it plainly. And it was to be written in such a way that it'd be easy to read and easy for the herald to run with it and to get the word out. Then the chapter 3 starts a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet on Shiginoth or something like that. We'll pick it up next time in the finish the final chapter, because now Habakkuk sings praises to God when he sees God's righteousness and his plan. The trouble's there, but the solution's coming.